Good morning, almost good afternoon to all of you. My name is Regina Hutchins. I'm from Cincinnati Health Department, and I have no financial relationships or any other conflicts of interest that I need to disclose. Today I'm going to talk to you, well, I'll give you a little history about myself. I am an RN, and my PhD is in public health. And the situation I'm going to talk to you about was emerging as I was finishing my doctoral studies. So today I'm going to be talking to you about how the community partnership that provides a safety net for school children. Okay, so the learning objectives today is to discuss how the partnerships can increase the outcomes and leverage resources. I want to explain why partnership can increase program sustainability, and I'm going to do all of that by explaining and sharing this case study about how one health department and school district successfully partnered to develop school-based health center sites. Okay, so I want to give you a little bit of history of what was going on at the time. So we know that in 2010, that's when all this stuff started going on. There were 8.7 million children in the United States without health insurance, or some of those that did have insurance were lacking access to preventive care, or the quality of that care was falling far below standards. Okay, so in the literature, we found that children between the ages of 12 and 17 were more likely to lack having a medical home than children 0 to 5. And that makes sense to us because we know from 0 to 5, they're getting their immunizations, they're getting ready for preschool or kindergarten, so they're going to the doctor. If they're getting there, they're getting there a little more often, but after that, not much is going on. And remember, the history in our country is that if it's not broken, don't fix it. So a lot of people just aren't going to the doctor, right? And we know that the disparities were showing up, of course, with race, ethnicity, socioeconomic situations and stuff. So there are a lot of gaps on who we were seeing ending up in the emergency rooms, what's going on. Okay, so the lack of health care access was affecting children's health, equity, and the impacts on their learning and academic performance. We'd see situations where, because people are in this mindset, you go to the doctor when you're sick, they'd wait, go to the doctor when they're sick, and sometimes siblings and stuff of children would miss school along with the child that was sick. So more from the literature, we were finding out that at that time, you remember in 2010, all this stuff about the Affordable Care Act is rolling out. So ACA, with the implementation of ACA, they were saying we want to evaluate health services and programs using evidence-based research, and we need to measure how is this really increasing access to care. We know that having insurance is only one part of this whole Affordable Care Act. I mean, it's a good part. You need insurance, but if you still don't have a place to get to, or if there are other barriers such as transportation and so forth, then, you know, we've provided one piece, but we're still not getting to the goal. The quality of health care need to be measured with this, the standards of care, and what's the effectiveness of the programs or services that are being funded. So now I'm going to explain to you what happened in Cincinnati during this time. So in Cincinnati, in 2010, the Cincinnati Health Department was forced to redesign its financially threatened school-based health center. Now, before that, we didn't think that the school-based health center project or program was threatened. But remember, in 2010, across the nation, we were having economic downturns. So the city council decided, they voted to just eliminate this entire school-based program. Now, this was a problem because in the community, first of all, it happened over Christmas break. The financial year was at the end of the year. So the students were in school. They had nurses. Some of them are asthmatic, diabetics, and stuff, and they're getting a lot of this care at school over winter break. So they leave, what, mid-December for their winter break? they're going to return to school after New Year, and there is no nurse, and there was no warning or anything. So the this was really a problem because the school-based health center, they didn't have a health center, but the school program has existed in Cincinnati since around 1970 or maybe even before that. And the reason city council decided to eliminate it is because, of course, when finances are low, you're looking at what is it that we really have to do. School health programs is not an essential public health service. So naturally, to council members, we can cut that. They weren't considering what this service really meant to the community. In 2010, most of the operating budget for the school health program came out of the city's general fund. So as far as they were concerned, they weren't doing anything harmful to the community. Okay, the Cincinnati Public School District lacked adequate funding to pay for school nurses, so they couldn't pick up the leverage, you know, or cover the bases because they said, well, we didn't have the money to do it, and this program has been going on for years. Okay, so because of that, basically what happened, because of the economic downturn, the city of Cincinnati could no longer afford to fund the program. So the community's response was, of course, naturally, with it emerging the way that it did and no warning, no city council meetings and stuff about it, the response was one of outrage. And so the school health program director, nurses, staff, members, parents, everyone, you know, the phones are ringing off the hook. They're like, we have to get together and do something. So what they did was got together and just said, we're going to create a community action plan. And they had a really strong partner, Interact for Health, provided leadership in this plan. They wanted to make sure that those services that the students had and the parents were used to would not be interrupted in the middle of the school year. They led a planning effort to enhance the school health services and to develop a sustainable long-term model. So the Community Partners Action Plan was to, first, they wanted to inform City Council of their disapproval of this decision. They wanted to demand that Council would reconsider its decision and do something different. And they decided that they were going to do this by having rallies at City Hall. And they did. They filled up the city chambers with parents, students told their own stories of what was important. And they called advocates from child welfare and health, other health advocates. They also did interviews and stuff on TV and on a radio station. The community, this is really awesome as a researcher to watch this emerge, this whole thing. So, but basically the goal was to influence city council to change its decision and to not eliminate the school-based health center program. So the community partners work plan was to determine the need and to build a case of support for a sustainable integrated care service model, to consider how a collaborative approach could help them get funding and new partners, and to integrate data and develop a map to help identify and predict the most sustainable choices. Okay, so when all, of course all this stuff happened, and it happened to be an election year coming up, so that worked really well. because they were like, we will remember this at election time. Okay, so the city council did agree to cancel the decision for the immediate elimination of the program. They agreed to fund the program until the end of that current year. So, okay, that was okay, but still the families were like, well, we don't want it to still go away, but at least they were going to have that immediate coverage. They also demanded that city council said, well, since this is so important to you and you're filling up the chambers and you're bringing all these children in here, making us feel bad like we don't care about kids, we want you to come up with a plan on how you are going to be able to sustain your own program, because this is not an essential public health program, and when times are hard and stuff, we have to cover the things that have to be covered. And as far as they were concerned, that's not something that had to be covered. Okay, so the community decided to develop a steering committee and it involved that Interact for Health. The Board of Education was there. Of course, the Cincinnati Health Department was there. Some of the advocates like Growing Well Cincinnati. We had the hospitals, Children's Hospital, and other hospitals. We didn't know that they were going to be interested, but like Mercy Hospital and Deaconess Hospital, once the community came together to say that we want this need met, these partners started emerging. So that was really nice to see, too. Sometimes I just want to remind you all, there's advocates and partners out there, but they need to know that you need them. So be vocal. Let them know what you need. So Growing Well is a collaborative, and it's already developed. It develops school services, and then they brought other partners that were doing federally qualified health centers and Children's Hospital, who had already opened up school-based health centers. And again, sorry about the misspelling there. Mercy Hospital is a system down there that they were involved in wanting to help provide services. So the schools that actually would work going from this model to shift from school nursing to school-based health centers would need to have a population of about 600 students. It worked in urban or needy communities where a lot of poverty is, because 80% of the schools, or if they the student body that get free or reduced lunch, makes them eligible for certain benefits. Okay, they have to have identified unmet health needs. So sometimes you could have a large school and a large population may be on free or reduced lunch, but their parents have resources or they get them to the doctor, so a program like this wouldn't work in an area like that. The schools have to feel like they're ready for a partnership, and they should want this service to be provided full-time. So this is just a slide of some of the different partners in the area that got involved in this movement. Okay, the end result, ultimately what happened was that by using the Affordable Care Act funding sources, the health department, the school district, and Interact for Health were able to collaborate and redesign a traditional school nurse program to a sustainable school-based health center model. Now I'm going to give you a little history about school-based health centers, or just tell you. The health department, if it becomes a school-based health center model, the health department or the provider, whoever the provider is, can now bill for services. And that's something that's a big deal that we need to be thinking about across the nation, because with normal school nursing programs, they cannot bill for services. They may be doing the exact same thing, but if you're wearing a cap called school-based health center, you can now bill for those services. So that was kind of interesting to find. The school district, it works well in Cincinnati because the school district provides the space. They pay for the utilities, the electricity, and everything, so there's no overhead cost for whoever that provider is going to be. In Cincinnati, the public schools, they have this model called a community learning center. They want to be the hub of the community, and they accomplish this by making the buildings available for other things, not just for academics during the day to the students. So that for them, that was win-win, because they can now fulfill some of their community learning center goals. And the community partnership and collaborative approach was nice, because everyone is coming together to provide these needs for the children that they feel are most needy. So what I was doing at the time was a qualitative study. I wanted to look at the school-based health centers, and this just happened to happen. So I was like, "Ooh, wow, I hit the jackpot." Now, it was kind of bad that it was services were being taken away, but it was really interesting to be in a situation to see this thing evolving and turning into something else, and to allow me to be a participatory researcher at that time. I hadn't really planned on it that way. Okay, so it's a qualitative study. The title of the study is The Perceived Influence of the Affordable Care Act on School Health Program Preventive Care. My research questions was, what are the perceived outcomes of this school health program. And then the second thing I wanted to know was, what is the perceived impact of the Affordable Care Act? Because it's brand, it was like it's newly being implemented. And so I used interviews and documents to review, and the conceptual framework that I was coming from was the life course health development. So from the interviews, there were some findings that I was able to like group together. The program description, they were using a public health model, of course, and the focus was about prevention and early screening. So they're doing dental screenings, vision screenings, health screenings, physicals, and all sorts of things like that in the school. The program changes was really a crisis for them because they were going switching from a regular school health model to now the school-based health center model, and the Affordable Care Act was influential in that for them because it provided capital funds. It just happened to be the first time that this large amount of money was being promoted to help do school-based health centers. The program outcomes and barriers was some things that was starting to emerge, that it was increasing access to children, and so this whole notion about secured funding and the sustainability was still a threat because they're like, well, you know, is this going to work? The city council was only going to allow this to go on for from December to the end of the school year, so how do we keep it going after that? The message to the policymakers that they wanted to get was that the school health programs are needed, they're inexpensive, they're convenient, families can get the care that they need, and it's a good investment, and to the community is a safety net. So the document review basically showed the same findings. There wasn't a lot of difference that I found there. The emergent themes was that the first one was that the school health program where city council, they kind of missed the point that the community viewed this as a safety net. That this, for a lot of their families, this was the only point of access for these children to get care. And so this whole thing about the school-based health center model versus the school nurse model was a problem even within the agency, because some of the nurses where there wasn't going to be a plan for it to be a school-based health center started feeling like they weren't appreciated. We've been doing the exact same thing. How is it that our program is being cut, or if it's not going to turn into a school-based health center, now all of a sudden what I do is no longer valued. So there some of these were some themes that was coming out. But the main thing about the school-based health center model and why they move that way is because even though the school nurse program and the school-based health center program may be doing the same services, with it being called a school-based health center and going through the regs that's required for that, it did allow for them to be able to pay. And remember, city council had already told them, you need to make this a sustainable model. So when I looked at I started comparing what was going on. I wanted to understand the differences between the traditional school nurse model and the school-based health center model. In 2010, they had 50 RNs across the schools, whereas when they switched to the school-based health center model, they reduced down to 26. This model changed the staffing. So city council started asking the questions, where did you need all those RNs in the first place? Well, I'm an RN, and we think, yes, you do need us. However, we did find that there's a smarter way that you can provide this care and these services. So in 2012, when they changed the model, they moved it. They did a blend of school health assistants with RNs, and it helped decrease the number of RNs. They brought on some more nurse practitioners for the areas where it's really needy, and they actually add some doctors. At least one. Okay. Also, in 2010, it was all RN. Now they have RN, school health assistants, MDs, and they use volunteers. They brought in AmeriCorps workers. In 2010, the funding only came from the city health, from the city council, or from our local government. When they switched to the new model, now they can get reimbursements from the Affordable Care Act. The old model did not make them FQHC, which is federally qualified health center. Under the new model, they're federally qualified health centers now, and they can get some additional reimbursements. And back in 2010, it was only one, and by the end of 2012, City was running three school-based health centers. So the program outcomes they had in the three short years was that 93.17% of their students were vaccinated, compliant. They did more than 48,000 medical triages, more than 37,000 vision, hearing, and dental screenings. They started doing BMIs, and when they would do referrals and stuff and the students needed to go to the doctor, they had more than 86,000 encounters with students that needed to have some type of medical intervention. So we found that the perceived influence of the Affordable Care Act is that ACA provides school-based health center capital money, that it supported the school-based health centers, and that it allowed the school-based health centers to function like a medical home. The ultimate finding was that the community mobilized into action by developing a partnership and a collective collaborative effort to create sustainability. They wanted to maintain the safety net for their for the school children. They accomplished that. The program used the Affordable Care Act funding opportunities to change that model. So timing was just perfect in that particular situation. Okay, so the limitations of the study, I have to share this with you, was that it was only one school district in Cincinnati. The outcomes that was reported from the school district and at the health department. There wasn't an outside evaluator, and the outcome reports do not include the student or the parent's perception. Okay. There's some implications for social change I'd like to share. It provides some of the current data on ACA, so we need to know what's going on with that. It helped us increase healthcare access, which is a goal for Healthy People 2020. And I'm gonna go on and just show you a couple of the pictures. These school-based health center partners are federally qualified. They have three dental centers, one vision center, one nurse practitioner, and three of the centers are operating to provide care throughout the whole community. They do acute illness, they do annual physical, sports physical, asthma management, chronic disease care, health education, prevention and early intervention. There's a picture of the vision center. They do on full vision care from the exam to the providing of the glasses, the fitting, everything is done right there, and it's inside the school building. There's another picture of it, the vision center. They now have a full dental service in one of the schools, filling cavities and stuff, not just screening for cavities. And this was all able to be accomplished with the schools, the family, and the students' engagement. So if you all have any questions about this that I could answer, I bought some cards, and I will share and tell you more because it's like really awesome. They're up to 13 school-based health centers. There was one, and when I left, because I was like, let me get a count, they're up to 13, and so this really worked well for the community. Thank you, and I'm sorry for going over. It's really exciting.
So thank you, and thank you to all our wonderful panelists today. I just want to introduce myself real quickly. I'm Charles Cange. I'm one of the co-moderators here. I'm coming from the Health Policy Program in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at the University of Maryland. So as an anthropologist, I want to ask the first question here. Alvin brought up a really good point about different cultures between community members and academics. And he mentioned that there tends to be a perception that community members are passionate, maybe too anecdotal, rely a lot on lived experience, whereas academics are seen as objective, a little bit cold, kind of serious. So I don't know who wants to take a stab at that. Maybe Alvin first, to see kind of what your take is on what that means to have this cultural difference between the two groups.
Yeah, I mean, I probably would be interested.
Do you want to come up to the mic here?
I'd be more interested in hearing other people's perceptions, because I've already sort of said what mine is, which is that
there is this perceived, if not real, sort of cultural difference between the cold, objective academic and the passionate community member who's coming into research to try to change the world, right, as opposed to trying to study some objective phenomena. And I'm interested to hear what others have to say. I think what bridges that potentially is that we are ultimately all trying to improve the world. I mean, most researchers, certainly in public health or in health arenas, are ultimately trying to change the world. And, you know, if we keep that in mind, then maybe we can find some middle ground and some way of providing wins for the community, some immediate wins, even as we have a longer term, longitudinal trajectory for our research. I think there's some way of thinking about it in those sort of dual ways of there's a long agenda, but what are the wins for the community along the way? But I'm much more interested in hearing other people.
Does someone else want to answer? Does someone else in the panel want to answer the question? Sure.
What I was going to ask about specifically was the, I've gotten more reading about dealing with effective communication with the science kind of thing. But one thing that I still struggle with, that, you know, have been given some good answers, but would like more, is specifically addressing the passionate side, saying to someone, I hear your passion, and I'm so glad you're here, but that's wrong. And you're compromising the integrity of our science if you keep saying it that way. Obviously, that's not an effective way to communicate with someone who, you know, whose home or family or life is being affected. And that's something that I've really been struggling with. So I was hoping within your question that specifically could be addressed.
Just to repeat that for the recording, so the question kind of essentially is how to deal with conversations where community members might feel that the scientist or researcher is diminishing or kind of not listening to or putting down maybe the lived experience.
Well, or if the activist community member doesn't understand that they're not speaking correctly, and then are thereby compromising the integrity of science, really scares a lot of scientists away.
Okay. Great. Let's have one of the panelists respond. I don't know if panelists or someone they want to come up here. Or you guys will find. I don't know. Who wants to?
I think one thing that's really important is the value of qualitative research that maybe isn't recognized as much in the academic community, although I think it's getting better, but I think that it needs to get a lot better for, and I think if qualitative research is acknowledged and is published about, then you're starting to bring those fields together.
And I would just like to comment on the importance of the development of a trusting relationship. It's just really the foundation of getting any work done at all. So it's important that you start where the community is in terms of where they are in their interpretation of the issues and the problem. And if the researcher can't go there, I think you're going to start off, you know, in a really difficult way. So you need to really never say you're wrong, okay? That would be the last thing you might want to say to somebody in the community.
No, please.
I was just going to add, as a community member, the researcher who actually helped me develop this presentation, I mean, we have gone head to head, so to speak, versus her objective methodology versus what I think is realistic for patients, you know, like, well, you shouldn't be educating them about this because that will be our intervention. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to withhold care just for the sake of science, which will get funded one day. And so, but I think being able to have that strong disagreement because you have a foundation of trust and respectful yet bold communication is the foundation, because eventually we find a way to wiggle it to where it can meet science yet meet what I feel are the immediate needs for the community. But it also helps in Montana, and we do a lot of telephone conference calls and all of that, and there's nothing like sitting down face to face and, so to speak, hammering out those kind of issues.
I would say that on the academic side, we need to remember that you can put in with the limitations and stuff, so you shouldn't have to worry about the integrity, as long as you as a researcher are thinking about what are the limitations or the limitations that are going on. As long as you disclose that, you have not breached the integrity because you're sharing what the limitations are.
And I also wanted to say, you can also hold both, right? So it's possible to say to folks, right, so that's a lived experience, and we honor that, and the science doesn't tell us that yet. So, you know, for instance, when we knew that people were dying from the treatments in AIDS, folks would say, oh, the data doesn't show that. Good. So let's work up, while you work on the data, I'm telling you, in the lived experience of how many funerals I'm going to, the treatments are not working. Start studying that. So you can illuminate what someone has said or point out the limitations of what someone has said without negating what they've said. You can say, yeah, and yet we don't know that scientifically, but you raise something interesting for us to begin to look at.
Great, let's go to a different questioner. Sure, why don't you stand up and tell us your question, please.
All right. So I wanted to say first, in support of everything you guys are saying, that qualitative work can be very satisfying as a researcher too, when you want to be able to take that voice, then you don't have to say you're in a two experience. In my data, that's really wrong. But my question is about the definition of a community member that I think Alvin brought up in his presentation that I've been struggling with, and that is going into a community to invite us in to do research with them, and then hiring community members, and to figure out who counts as well as stakeholders though in our research process. And so I was wondering if the panel or any other people have experiences with community-based research in defining whose community and who's academic.
Just for the recording's sake, so the question is about how to define who is a community member and what happens when community members are hired into a project, and if that shifts the definition. So would someone like to take a stab at this on the panel?
In the case that I shared with you, the community was everyone. It's the students, it's the parents, it was the Children's Hospital, who are professional staff, Interact for Health, who's a funder and stuff. And so I know in some cases they would be considered not the community, but they were all part of the community, and they're all being affected by that decision that was being made. So I think that where we might need to be cautious on a case-by-case basis, whatever it is that you're working on, but remember, stakeholders, if they have some involvement in it, they're part of the community as well.
I think that's absolutely true, and I guess what I would add to that is that in CBPR, what I hope we're doing is trying to privilege the voices that are typically not privileged. And so there is a hierarchy of community inside of that. If I'm the executive director of a fairly well-funded CBO, then I'm not as unprivileged as someone who is an unaffiliated community member. And that voice needs to be privileged more than mine. On the other hand, if I'm compared to Dr. Margarita Lightfoot, who runs the CAPS Research Center and has hundreds of millions of dollars at her disposal, I'm less privileged than she, and my voice needs to carry more privilege than hers. So it's true, we're all community members, ultimately. And yet what we're trying to do, I hope, in CBPR is always ask who are the least privileged of our voices that are in the room, and let's raise those to the top.
We have a question in the back. Questioner, can you stand up?
We'll take one.
Well, I mean, I think that the technical skills are important to research. So there's no getting around that. And research is a particular kind of inquiry that has a structure to it, and that you've got to be both equipped and willing to follow the structure in order to actually be engaged in research, as opposed to other ways of knowing, which to me are as important as research ways of knowing, right? So let's take that as a given. But I think what's useful in our experience in ARC is to train people in the technical skills, right? And people have aptitudes in both of those domains. So there are people who will not take to the technical skills as quickly as others, but it will surprise you, some of the community members that actually can pick up research skills very quickly. And it is shocking, to me at any rate, how difficult it is for some technical people to pick up the soft skills that we also tried to train as a part of the ARC. But it's important to train both. I think it's really important to spend time as community members talking to faculty members and academic researchers in a structured workshop setting about, here's how you talk to people, here's how you don't. Here's an example of how you say that, here's an example of how you never say that. And try to train up those soft skills as well. And it's true, people come with aptitudes and choose jobs based on their aptitudes, and it's sometimes hard to bridge that gap. But you will find community members that can pick up the technical skills, and you will, thank goodness, find, you know, technicians who can pick up the soft skills or who come even with the soft skills. I can detect in some of the academics here that they've got those soft skills, that they really do understand how you talk to people, how you engage with community members. But ultimately, we want to have all of that at our disposal to be able to have successful community-engaged research.
Thank you. Unfortunately, we're out of time, so I'm going to invite anyone who has an additional question to come to the front. But before that, can we give another hand to this wonderful panel? Excellent topic. And thank you all for coming. Have a nice conference.